Welcome to Friday. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review, in which the entire week suddenly makes sense. Do you want big money out of politics? Do you know how to do that? There is an idea on your Seattle ballot right now. Initiative 122 says it would sap some of the power of money and make city elections more honest. Opponents say don't believe those promises. We have one of those opponents, Bob Mahon, attorney and former member of the Seattle Ethics and Elections Committee. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
And here to convince you to vote yes on Initiative 122, organizer Brianna Thomas, who also worked on SeaTac's $15 a minimum wage campaign. Hi, Brianna.
Good morning.
Initiative 522 would raise property taxes a few bucks to give voters vouchers that they can donate to political campaigns, and candidates would be limited in how much they can spend. Brianna, why? What do you want to accomplish with that?
Well, what we're hoping to accomplish with 122 is to limit the influence of big money in our local elections and strengthen the voices of ordinary voters. Right now, candidates can spend up to 16 hours a week dialing to the same 3,500 people that give to campaigns instead of getting out and talking to the people who matter, and that's the voters.
Limiting the influence of big money. What's wrong with that, Bob Mahon?
I don't think there's anything wrong with the goal. I think the problem is that this initiative does nothing to take money out of politics. All it does is shift part of the funding to taxpayers and likely benefits the very incumbents and special interests that proponents are hoping to neutralize.
Why? What's the flaw in your view?
Like the chief flaw is the timing. The vouchers would go in the mail to voters right after New Year's, the first business day after New Year's Day. And at that point, there are very few insurgent candidates that are going to be in a position to collect those vouchers. It's instead going to be incumbents. It's going to be special interests. They're going to be positioned to scoop up those vouchers in early January. And what we'll see is an avalanche of New Year's mailings, much like you see an avalanche right now of mailings when ballots drop. And those are going to be the benefit of incumbents and those who can afford to spend money to collect those vouchers.
Brianna, that's his top objection, that candidates, if you announce early, you're well organized, you can basically monopolize the voucher money. What do you say?
I say that right now the monopoly we ought to be fighting is the corporate interests that are already showing signs of corruption in our city. Just recently, Triad developers attempted to extort the support of John Grant, and I think that we need to work on a system that protects candidates from that sort of vulnerability. We've got the support of the League of Women Voters, 16 out of 18 city council candidates, Jim McDermott, all of the King County Democrats, and the NAACP. These are people that we trust to help protect our community and uphold our values. They're standing with us because they understand that big money is a problem.
We're talking about Initiative 122 in Seattle. So, Bob, if you said at the top that you do think we can do better when it comes to money in politics. So what's your alternative? What should we do about the influence of money in our elections?
Well, I think there are a few things, but I think it's worth pointing out that this initiative is funded by the very dark money that proponents are concerned about. There is almost $1 million that's been put into this by 10 donors, six of which are dark 501c organizations.
Briefly, what do you mean by dark money?
I mean dark money. I mean it's organizations that take advantage of the federal tax code and collect donations without having to disclose who the donors are and turn around and spend money. Again, $1 million from 10 donors that's funding this. And that, to me, is the hypocrisy of talking about small money when it's funded by 10 out-of-state, or not all out-of-state, but 10 dark money organizations.
Okay, then I'll re-ask you my question. I want to give Brianna the chance to react to that. Dark money, Brianna.
I'm sorry, I can't seem to hear Bob on my end of the line.
Okay.
But what I do know is that the no side of this issue is currently being funded by corporate interests that are interested in keeping the status quo going. And I think that that's the dark money that we're all worried about. This initiative is about talking to real people, and it's about making sure we close the revolving door so that recent elected officials can't go right back to City Hall to continue to support the agendas that they are originally working on with their special relationships that we all don't have access to. I mean, I understand that whenever you're on the forefront of trying something that's a little bit different, the status quo is going to ripple at that. And I think they should. They should be concerned that we're going to put power where it belongs, and that's back with ordinary people who are working moms, who are riding buses, who are taking care of children and participating in their communities, who don't have the money to buy influence. That's where the power needs to be, and that's what 122 does.
Brianna Thomas with the Yes on Initiative 122 campaign. Thank you, Brianna. And now Bob Mahon, opponent of 122, moving off this initiative, our last thing I want to know from you is just briefly, what's your idea to ameliorate the problem, if you think there is one, with money in politics?
I think the Supreme Court's made it difficult to eliminate money in politics. I think the best answer is a combination of transparency, strong election laws, which Seattle has, and perhaps a matching program that matches small donors, encourages the very sort of grassroots politics that is healthy for Seattle. That's something that that my predecessor as Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission chair and I have supported. That's a measure that doesn't have the administrative costs that this system has and doesn't have the potential for abuse. So I think that's the answer.
Bob Mahon, with the former member of the Seattle Ethics and Elections Committee, coming out against Initiative 122 in Seattle. Bob, thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
So, again, whether you want to get money out of politics or not, you've got this option in front of you. And we've been talking about it on KUOW's Week in Review. And my guests now and for the whole hour are Erica C. Barnett, C is for Crank, Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican State Senate Majority Leader, and Knute Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut and a columnist at Seattle Magazine. So briefly, your take on what you heard, the arguments for and against this Get Money Out of Local Politics initiative in Seattle.
Well, I don't think that anything will get money out of local politics. I mean, full stop. But as long as we have Citizens United, we're going to have independent expenditures. We're going to have so-called dark money. I don't think that Initiative 122 is going to in itself change that. I do hear the arguments about unintended consequences, one of which is that this will encourage bundling by organizations like SEIU, like corporate interests, to get all of their members to give to the same candidate. And I thought Bob's point about the early mailings was really interesting, and it was one that I haven't heard before. And I do think that he's very likely right, that if you have a barrage of mailings in January, people who are, you know, getting those vouchers at the same time are going to go, well, I guess this is how I spend my vouchers, rather than holding on to them until, you know, potentially August or October, November.
Bill Finkbeiner, you ran a campaign.
Yeah. You know, money in politics is a problem, and it's a really hard one. I don't think there's any perfect solution that's going to sort of make all the problems with that go away. But I think this is a really interesting approach, and I think it's worth trying. I think that there will probably be, you know, some unintended consequences, but I think that there's some real issues existing in our campaign finance system right now where there are the people who are giving the bulk of the money in politics, it's too small. I also think this initiative does some good things that, you know, have to do with better reporting and putting in some stronger ethics laws. So I think it's worth a try.
Len, your take, Knute Berger.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting. Some of the things in the initiative seem reasonable in terms of trying to restrain sort of the revolving door between people who serve in city government and then return to lobby on behalf and the kind of concentration of power. There's some disclosure requirements for donations that are stronger and penalties and whatnot. So there's some bits and pieces in there that seem pretty reasonable. The voucher thing, it seems like a real flyer. I mean, like a real experiment, because I can see clearly how it could be abused. And
this is where you, the voter, get four $25 vouchers to spend on whichever candidate you like.
Exactly. And that money would be raised probably through a property tax.
Yeah.
And I'm not
a small
sure
amount, like $8 a year.
Yeah, I know.
Or something.
But, you know, we're spending a lot of money on property tax for infrastructure and that kind of thing. And so I think there's an argument to be made. It ought to come out of operating funds or some other source of revenue. So I'm not convinced that that's a good idea. And it in fact, even though it limits some of the donations, my sense is, and maybe I'm wrong, but it's not going to take money out of politics. It's not going to accomplish, you know, the goal. What it is you know, it's going to mean that there's going to be $3 million more coming in. Because I think the people who donate now are going to continue to donate. And then you'll have additional donations from people who wouldn't otherwise donate. So
we've been talking about City Initiative 122. I'm hearing from my panel. We heard from the yes, from the no on the campaign. We've heard some skepticism on our panel this morning that it's actually going to take money out of politics. We have a right, especially when it's independent expenditures. The Supreme Court has said that's your free speech. That's your money and your speech. But Bill Finkbeiner, who ran a campaign, saying, yeah, and at the same time, let's give it a shot. So it's going to be up to you now. It's on your ballot, this idea of vouchers to you, the voter, and limits on candidates who agree to go along with those limits. And it gets a little complicated, but you can find all our election coverage at KUOW.org. And we are going to continue with the top stories of the week. Justin Trudeau's looks, cyclists' rights, a school superintendent's departure, and finally, something good happening. Unless you were in San Francisco watching that happen last night. All that's coming up. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review continues now. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome to Friday. We've got Erica Barnett and Bill Finkbeiner and Knute Berger with you. And this week, Canada got more liberal once again in a national election. Canadians voted for the Liberal Party and their new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, son of the late Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. Justin is known for being young, 43, and for being a looker. So during the campaign, his conservative opponent, Stephen Harper, ran this TV ad against him. Picture three people sitting around an office desk. They're on a hiring committee, and they're looking at resumes.
Well, some interesting resumes we have here. Let's talk about Justin.
I see he's included his picture. Let's start with the experience section. Nothing about balancing a budget or making a payroll.
Didn't he say budgets balance themselves?
And what does the experience section say about keeping us safe?
Well, he wants to send winter jackets to Syria.
Like that will stop ISIS?
He's like a celebrity. He says things before thinking them through.
So what are his policies?
Legalizing marijuana. Is that the biggest problem we have to solve?
He has some growing up to do.
And he says he's going to cancel income splitting for families.
I guess pension splitting for seniors is next. So when has he ever had to make a tough choice?
People, being prime minister is not an entry-level job.
I'm not saying no forever, but not now.
Nice hair, though.
Justin Trudeau. He's just not ready.
Just not ready. Unprepared and a pretty boy. That was the unsuccessful ad by Stephen Harper against Canada's new prime minister. So, boy, they talked a lot about what he looks like. And we want to know now, what is the role of looks in politics in 2015, and what do we want that role to be? Novelist Paula Lee wrote about that this week at Salon.com. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
What did you think when you saw that ad?
I laughed inadvertently. I think that was part of the difficulty, which was I thought it was very funny, and I don't think I was supposed to.
Why funny?
I'm sorry?
Why funny?
It was quite clumsy. It seemed to be very outdated. The people speaking themselves seemed to be, it was badly acted, among other things.
Well, there's that.
I'm sorry?
There is that. What do you think they were going for? Why did Stephen Harper think that ad would resonate with voters?
Oh, well, that's precisely the problem, which is it seemed like it was from another era, graphically, design-wise, the entire setup. The artifice of the conversation, and the people communicating, but also that particular ad, they were apparently quite proud of it, and it ran for months and months. And the irony is that it completely backfired. Among other things, they did mention, "Oh, look, his photo is there with his ersatz resume," and that actually brought his picture to the attention of everybody watching that ad. And apparently they like what they saw.
So it was a very nice picture. Usually in those ads, you choose the one where it's a freeze frame where their eyes are half open or something. But it was him looking attractive, and they're making fun of him for looking attractive. Well, we want to talk about this question of what looks mean and are supposed to mean in politics. I felt, I'm curious what you think, I felt like that even though they were mocking a man, the campaign ad felt sort of anti-woman to me because it felt like they were saying he cares about his hair and implying that only petty women care about their hair that much. Did you get that?
Yeah, that was clearly the subtext, and I think several commentators noted that, meaning it was a very clear attempt, that comment, nice hair, at the disparagement is gendered, meaning it's a way to feminize Trudeau because the idea of caring about your looks and specifically your hair is understood to be a female concern. And so that was, you know, very much understood as a way to feminize him and therefore discount him as a serious candidate. And I think, again, that once again it backfired because I think certainly the younger voters, millennials in particular, were not at all misled by the connotations, understood the subtext, and were annoyed by it.
Well, what about the commentary we're hearing that he won in part because he's easy on the eye? I think he's easy on the eye. What's wrong with that? Is there something wrong with that?
Well, as I mentioned in that article I wrote for Salon, I think it's ignoring reality to say that he's not attractive. I think it's actually important to, you know, live in the real world and to say yes, he is in fact a good-looking man. But to my mind, once you get, you know, past the obvious, he is in fact a man, he is in fact young, he is in fact, you know, attractive, I say good, but so I'm not particularly moved politically by a politician's appearance. It does, however, get your interest.
Well, where do you think we are on that in 2015? Because we've talked about this my entire life, but where do you think we stand now in how much we take into account, for good or ill, a politician's looks?
I think there's sort of several ways to discuss that, but we are becoming far more mediatized than ever. That is an undeniable trend. So, you know, between selfies, social media, the proliferation of cameras, television, basically we're now profoundly, I think, living in a society where the lines between media and real life are, in fact, quite blurred. So the fact that Trudeau grew up in the public eye and is himself quite comfortable with celebrity, I think, helped him tremendously, not so much because it made him familiar to Canadians, it made him familiar with the media. And I think his complete ease in acting and interacting with the camera was one of the reasons why he comes off as so charming when he speaks. I watched several of the YouTubes where he's interviewed, and it was very clear he was quite comfortable. Those who do not grow up with cameras constantly on them often feel the distance between themselves on camera versus themselves in real life. And there is this supposed disparity between real life and the media.
Let's open this up to our panel. We have a former politician here, Republican State Senate Majority Leader X, Bill Finkbeiner. What's your experience with looks? You're a handsome man.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I appreciate that, Bill. I was going to say he's the only one here who's not a hair farmer on the in the panel today. But you know,
are remarkably shiny of
I got
hate.
A face for radio is what you're trying to say.
Well, how have your looks affected you in politics?
Oh, I think looks are a big are definitely an impact in political campaigns. I think if they weren't, you wouldn't see politicians put pictures of themselves, you know, in their advertisements. I think that they I think we as people often let impressions influence our judgment, and oftentimes incorrectly. I think that all the time we form impressions of people, and then we use facts to sort of back those impressions up, and instead of actually looking at the facts first. And I think that that's definitely a part of politics where impressions are an enormous part of how people decide to vote.
Well, if you go ahead, I'm sorry. It looks like you were.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I think the thing that's totally overlooked here is the fact that he's in a dynasty. Well, I think that, you know, the writer just brought that up, is the fact that he's just so comfortable in front of cameras because he's been there his whole life too. Makes a big difference.
I still want to know how your looks, you think, how they've played into your career.
I think, you know, when I first ran, I was 22 years old, and I think that when you're young, that there's a connotation that comes with that. Okay, you're fresh, you're energetic, and I think that that comes across because of the way that I looked. It's also definitely has some negatives, like everything. Some, you know, people, just as in this ad, will try to say, well, that also connotes inexperience or, you know, a lack of seriousness. But I think looks, you know, all the way through are part of that.
Did your lack of hair hurt you?
You know, the only campaign I lost was after I was pretty much bald.
Aha! So if we see more images than ever, you know, than when I was growing up. And so, Erica C. Barnett, you think we're more superficial than ever when it comes to picking the people supposed to make crucial decisions?
No, I don't think we're more superficial than ever. I think we're as superficial as we've ever been. I do think that, you know, Bill was talking about how it affects everyone to be, you know, to be looked at and judged on your looks, everyone running for office. But I think it is a specifically gendered thing. I mean, the fact that we can, like, look at, you know, John Edwards or Trudeau and say, this guy has hair, he's a pretty boy, let's not take him seriously. It's sort of a wink, wink, you know, kind of thing where you're saying he is feminine. And this is all just kind of a joke. When it's Hillary Clinton, you know, for example, or Carly Fiorina, who was mocked by Donald Trump for her looks.
Well, he is Donald Trump.
He is Donald Trump, the presidential frontrunner on the Republican side. Mm. So when that happens, there is a gendered component to it that is very different than what a man ever will experience, because part of women's work as politicians is to do this performance of femininity. And, you know, you can be Sarah Palin and not be taken seriously because you're pretty. And you can also be Hillary Clinton and not be taken seriously because you're too old to be in public as a woman.
Is there a difference in the way we mock Donald Trump's hair?
I think there is a difference. I think we mock Donald Trump's hair as sort of a silly thing, a vain thing for a man to be caring about. And why is he so vain about his hair? But if Hillary Clinton went out in public without doing the performative work that you have to do as a woman in public, and, you know, and just like wasn't wearing any makeup and didn't do her hair, and, you know, wasn't wearing her signature pantsuit, which gets, you know, far more press than anything any man in politics has ever gotten, you know, we would judge her and we would say, oh, I guess she's not trying anymore.
Final question to you then, Paula. Do you agree with Erica that it's still, we are still judging female politicians in an unfair way that men are not having to deal with?
Yes, I think it's a fairly complicated question, though, because it's not all women are judged when they are in the public sphere, and I think it is very true that you really can't win if you pay attention to your looks and groom yourself in order to be as on trend as possible. Then you're criticized for being superficial and vain. If you eschew makeup and try to go au naturel, then you're criticized for being sloppy. Some of this came forward, actually, with the criticism of Herman Cain's wife for being unfashionable and dowdy. And I was struck by that because I thought the criticism of her was, in fact, entirely unfair. And because, again, I actually personally don't really care what the candidates' wives wear. I'm not interested in what Hillary Clinton's wearing. I'm not looking to her specifically on leadership for fashion. If I were to look for that, I would open up a fashion magazine. I think partly what's disturbing and what is different is that our public figures are sort of expected to be all things at all times to all people, and a lack of think discernment between those different capacities is what's increasingly happening on social media. So again, the idea that we should even expect female politicians or female leaders to be also be fashion or clothes horses is to me a little bit absurd. But nonetheless, part of your job is, you know, if you are in public life, is to represent a certain ideal or a certain standard. And that your clothes and your grooming go along with that. But it is also still true that women in public life are held to a different standard, and there is an inordinate amount of discussion about how a candidate looks as opposed to most men. But again, what happened with Justin Trudeau is that he really sort of brought forth this idea of the candidate as a leader who is also exceptionally good-looking, and somehow this is important politically that he is so attractive. So,
Paula Lee wrote about that this week at Salon.com, the injection of looks into the Prime Minister campaign in Canada. Paula, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Also attractive is Knut Berger, the Mossback, who's been listening. And what do you think? What should the role of looks be in politics? I mean, it's up to us. We can try to change this,
right?
In the way we talk about it, the way we vote.
People have all kinds of personal reactions. I mean, I think the thing about Donald Trump's hair is that he purports to be a truth teller, but he's lying about his hairline. You know, I mean, there's something wrong about what's happening there. The Carly Fiorina, which Erica brought up, I think is a great example. I mean, first of all, Trump is a beauty contest judge, right? Mm. So, but his criticism of Carly Fiorina was that face. Like, okay, Mike Huckabee is not particularly good looking and he's fat. Mm-hmm. Has Donald Trump said anything about Mike Huckabee's face or his weight or anything? You know, so I think she's right that there's a, you know, much kind of narrower, more restrictive idea of what an acceptable female candidate is. With men, they're more colors in the rainbow as far as what men can be and which kind of archetypes they can appeal to politically. You can be the Jack Kennedy, Justin Trudeau type, but you can also be the grandfatherly, wise, you know, gray-haired man. You know, there are all kinds of they're like more archetypes for leaders and that kind of thing. I'm old enough to remember the original Trudeau, mm-hmm. and he was like the fifth Beatle.
Yeah,
I mean, in terms of celebrity, popularity, good looks, articulate.
Any date, was it Linda Ronstadt or somebody?
No, that was Jerry Brown.
Oh, sorry. he had some famous,
well,
famously beautiful.
Well, he had a wife, but yes, she was glamorous and, okay. and everything.
I'm so young.
You know, what really struck me about that ad was just, it was like the conservatives were being a caricature of what you think of as old stodgy conservative Canada being.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, well, he's young and he's handsome and he has hair.
That's
you know, you're supposed to have hair coming out your ears, you know, and your nose.
43 is not incredibly young.
No, it's not. No, certainly not. You know, and so, you know, I and also, you know, Trudeau ran a very Reagan-esque campaign in the sense that it was very positive. Positive solutions. The future is bright. He kept talking about sunny days. Think about sunny days. That's kind of echoes Reagan's Morning in America. Kind of. I mean, you know, he not only looked good, but he had a youthful message that resonated with his presentation. Hmm. And I think people obviously responded to that because, you know, he walloped the opposition.
We've been talking about looks and politics, and all this week we've been talking about how Canadian voters have reclaimed their country's liberal identity. Justin Trudeau, the new prime minister, says he intends to restore that country's compassionate, constructive voice in the world. And he's going to legalize recreational pot. Back with more KOW's Week in Review in a moment. We are assessing the import of the top stories of the week on the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Would you say Seattle children are about to become safer, or would you say Big Brother is about to throttle your rights? The city's about to expand its school zone speed cameras. 6 more cameras start generating citations on Monday. Tickets instead of just warnings. You could stop this if you wanted to. People have risen up against red light cameras in places, and they pulled them down. Bill Finkbeiner, what should we do here?
Yeah, I get concerned about remote policing, whether it's red light cameras or, a speed trap that's automated like this, even when it is in the school zone, which I understand that's the reason they put them there is because, you know, everybody's concerned about kids. But at the same time, I feel like we'd be better off as a society with a police car there, which I think would have an equal or, you know, better effect at actually slowing people down.
Why would we be better off as a society?
I don't for me personally, I don't like the idea of automated policing. I think it has connotations that impact the way we live and the way we think about authority.
What do you mean?
Make me nervous. Well, I just think when you have an ever-present authority that is automated, that is not a human being, then I think, you know, again, this is for me personally, I feel like that changes the way people react to it.
But it's not a judgment call. You're either speeding or you're not, and the police can't afford to be everywhere, Republican Bill Finkbeiner. It's cheaper than having cops on every...
Absolutely, you know. Understand the arguments for it. I just feel like it's different because it is there 100% of the time, 24/7, and it's automated. And I also think that a lot of these are being driven by desire for revenue as much as it is public safety. These tickets are $250 a piece. I think that it's a, it's kind of the slippery slope argument, but.
Okay. Erica C. Barnett, should we oppose them or welcome them?
I think
these speed cameras in school zones.
As you will probably not be shocked to hear, I think that we should welcome them. And I think, you know, your argument, Bill, that it just feels wrong is, you said several times, I just feel like. And I think it is a feeling thing. And I think it is getting used to technology and its role in all aspects of our lives. But policing is one of them. I think that there is so much need for policing in Seattle, in particular. In many different areas, you know, people in neighborhoods complain that property crimes are rampant, that there are shootings that go uninvestigated. Why would we put police officers sitting in cars when we don't have to? There is absolutely no reason that we need them. I myself have gotten an automated ticket, not for speeding, but for rolling through a red light. And, you know, it's a little shocking when you get it, but frankly, honestly, I would rather get that ticket in the mail than get pulled over by an officer and have that be at the discretion of the officer to decide whether to charge me, whether he or she thinks that I've made a convincing case or whatever. The fact that, you know, I'm white versus, you know, if I was black. I like the fact that it's not at the discretion of the officer. I think that the amount of the fine is perfectly appropriate for speeding through a school area where children are walking. I don't know what value we put on the life of a child, but I think that $250 is below that value.
A very clear no and a yes on speeding cameras in school zones. What about you, Canoe?
Well, I basically agree with Erica. Except, to me, it's a matter of how ubiquitous it becomes. In other words, if you put these cameras at major intersections where you're trying to make sure traffic slows and stops, and I think school zones is fine, you're going to remember a, you know, $200-plus fine. And let alone if you get a couple of those, your insurance rates are going to go up. You know, you're going to feel it in your pocketbook. So I think that's a case where it's effective. And, the technology provides a relatively objective measure. It has nothing to do with race or what kind of car you're driving or anything. It's fairly clear cut. However, I would hate to see those cameras like on every yield sign or every stop sign or every, you know, I mean, they're, when you drive across town and you, even if you're a careful driver, you're probably going to technically break the law at some point along the way. Maybe you didn't yield for a pedestrian because it was unclear if that person was actually going to cross the street or, you know, something like that. I would hate to have a system that was so pervasive and so kind of accurate that, you know, you were just kind of afraid to move anywhere because it was going to cost you so much money. So if there is a slippery slope, that would be the place I wouldn't want to slide to. But in terms of these school zones and the cameras as they're used now, I'd have no problem with it.
I want to let Bill respond to an interesting point from Erica that, well, get comfortable with technology, Bill. Here's a case where if there's a case where you're using technology for good and not for ill, it would seem to be in a school zone when you're speeding. Are you just not quite? Is it just your feeling about Big Brother coloring?
It basically is. I am not comfortable with where technology is going as far as how it's used, you know, by the government in sort of defense of law enforcement and defense. I am uncomfortable with sort of the conclusions that, because it's easy to say, well, you know, this is a school zone, and it's not that I don't care about kids. My kids walk to school. It's not that I don't, you know, want to see people drive slowly through there. But I really do think that it's not a gigantic leap to get to where Canute was, you know, where there's a lot of automation that could watch a lot of, you know, pieces of everybody's lives. And if you create sort of a system that's so perfect that people don't have to think, and that they know, you know, that there's a constant set of surveillance, which I don't think that, you know, the NSA is, you know, watching everything we do on our phones. But I do think that there's an incredible amount of information that's collected and an incredible effect that automation has on our lives, and that we have to think about that before we put these things in place. And I don't think that the school zone or the red light cameras are, you know, the thing that's going to destroy our society. But I think if we just sort of keep taking these steps, and it's always easy to justify to say, well, you know, how much is a life worth? How much do we want our streets or our communities to be safer? But there is a sort of a logical conclusion to that, where I think we lose something in our society that, you know, has to do with sort of personal freedoms and personal responsibilities.
Okay, well, maybe we wait on the speed camera tickets until we have the self-driving cars.
There we go.
I was just thinking that. Does the car get the ticket?
Give the car the ticket. All right, well, let's keep talking about the judgment calls we make in traffic, because the next question is, should we let bicyclists in Seattle treat stop signs as yield signs? Let them go through a stop sign without stopping if they think it's safe. That's the law in Idaho, has been for decades. Now San Francisco's considering it. Why not Seattle, Erica?
Well, I would say there is no reason why not Seattle. I think that, you know, in practice, what has happened in Idaho, and there are, as you said, decades of data to back this up, it's not less safe. There aren't more accidents. And it just acknowledges what everybody already does. When you show up at a stoplight, or a stop sign rather, as a cyclist, and you see nobody else around and don't come to a full stop, that is common practice, and motorists, frankly, do it too.
But we don't want to acknowledge every common practice as being a great idea because people do it.
Well, the thing is, you know, I love this example in San Francisco where the cyclists did a sort of demonstration of what this would look like if people actually followed the law, and it drove motorists crazy, because what happens is the law is you're supposed to be single file. Every cyclist comes to a full stop at a four-way stop. Looks and goes. And it backed up traffic for blocks and blocks, because that is an absurd way of running your traffic system. It does not work. And, you know, if we're going to be ticketing the vulnerable user of the road for treating a stop sign at an empty intersection as a yield sign, I think that's really misplaced priorities when we have cars, which are much more dangerous, violating laws all the time.
Well, if bikes not obeying stop signs strictly is called an Idaho stop, cars not doing it is called a California stop.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and, you know, California was notorious for that. I lived in San Francisco. Everybody California stopped there. The cars don't do it. And there are other kind of unwritten rules that you don't necessarily codify in law, but everybody understands. Like in San Francisco, it was always understood that it was so hard to make a left turn that when the light turned red, you let two cars or so turn left, because they were never going to get a break in traffic otherwise.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. Those informal things, when they're codified, can cause problems. But I think it's actually a benefit to traffic and to bicyclists to have to be liberal on the literal stop.
Okay.
I was just going to say, the one worry I have is the idea that the kind of that red octagonal stop sign is supposed to be unilateral.
Right, you know, a stop doesn't mean stop.
Stop means stop.
Yeah.
Always means stop. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of thing. And it's becoming more conditional. Like, you see those crosswalks where there's a pedestrian figure and a stop sign and an arrow basically saying, well, stop if there's a pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, you're always supposed to stop if there's a pedestrian.
You are, but they use the stop sign as a stop if.
Yeah.
You know, type of thing. So I just wonder if, talk about slippery slopes, are we slippery sloping the stop sign?
There's a lot of slippery slopes in Seattle.
Slippery.
That we know. And San Francisco. Okay, two clear votes for letting bicyclists roll through. Bill Finkbeiner.
Jerry, they're rolling through now. I mean, I don't think, you know, I'm trying to remember the last time I saw bicyclists stop all the way at a stop sign. I don't think it happens much, and I think, this is whether they pass the law or not, it's not going to change.
Okay, but what do you think about it?
About whether the
you
law
think we should? Do we think we should change the law so that?
I think that there's a real tension between bicyclists and cars, especially in urban areas, and it's not just because people who drive cars are jerks. It's because, you know, bicyclists on the road do make it more dangerous for both bikers and car drivers, and our infrastructure just wasn't built for it. And it's not the stop signs that's the problem. It's the road widths, and it's the lack of sort of off-road trails and that kind of thing. I don't think the stop signs is a big culprit. I think it's more about the speed of traffic.
So you're voting yes for letting cyclists roll through stop signs?
Just like they do now.
Really? Okay.
I think that one great irony of this whole debate is that a lot of people who want to get cyclists off their quote unquote roads are, you know, like, for example, where I live, Rainier, there's going to be, you know, a little more leeway given to cyclists. You know, they did a rechannelization. It's a little safer for cyclists. But they say, you know, you can just use the neighborhood streets. You don't have to use the arterials. Well, the neighborhood streets are where the four-way stop signs are that opponents of this Idaho law say cyclists should have to come to a full stop. So they're saying, don't drive on our arterials, but we're going to make it harder for you to drive on the neighborhood streets where we say we want you to drive or to ride.
I think we've got to do something about the enmity, something about, you know, really, we're talking about stop signs, but really, I hear this all the time from drivers who honestly can't stand bicyclists, that you are smug, you know, you think it's your roads when they're designed for us, not you. I mean, really, there's a lot of resentment. This is not just about octagonal signs, right? Nodding Bill Finkbeiner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that there's a little bit of a sense of moral superiority that people that ride bikes have. I probably get it. You know, I ride to work occasionally, and you feel a little bit like, yeah, I'm out here in the elements and, you know, not producing any carbon.
Right.
I'm doing my thing.
Bill, have you ridden a bike on a Seattle street or on a Kirkland street?
Yeah. Well, I rode one down last night to meet my friends to watch the game, partly because I knew I was, you know, maybe have a couple beers and, and don't want to have, even though I think it's just as illegal
on a bike. Drunk cycling.
You'll suffer.
Which do you feel, you know, morally, it's like I'm absolutely not going to get in the car, but getting on a bike?
Right. Yeah. And do you feel morally superior when you are on two wheels? Do you come to a full stop at every stop sign?
No, I was driving my bike last night, and I was thinking about it when I blew through that stop sign on the side street.
And do you feel morally superior?
I'm saying that Bill's exactly right. I think that there is, you know, that there is a serious issue where where the roads were not built and the infrastructure was not built to share the road with bicycles. At the same time, you know, it's absolutely got to happen because people need that alternative to be able to get where they're going, and they should have that alternative. But it's I think that the road laws are followed much less by people on bikes, and partly, you know, is that feeling that you get when you ride the bike, which you feel like, okay, I've got to get where I'm going, and I'm sort of, you know, out here on my own a little bit more.
Okay, I'm pedaling hard to get through the rest of the news in the next 10 minutes, so we've got to leave it there. Again, we're talking about San Francisco considering what Idaho's long done. Should Seattle do it? Let bicyclists treat stop signs as yield signs. Coming up, you're at a time of turmoil. Your state school superintendent is taking the fast lane out of town. We'll get at that in a second. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. There's so much turmoil over public education in this state, and now your school superintendent is about to leave. Randy Dorn said yesterday he won't run for a third term. So what does that mean for our kids? KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins is here. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Bill.
First of all, why is Randy Dorn leaving?
I think Randy Dorn wants to spend more time in Palm Springs in February than he's getting to right now. And I think, like a lot of Olympia insiders, there comes a day when you say, you know what? I've spent enough Februarys hanging out with the legislature. I'm going to go to Palm Springs.
He said a little more.
Austin.
Yeah. He said a little more than that, though. He's not shy about his opinions.
No. Randy Dorn is pugilistic. I have interviewed him, and I've sat across the table from him, and there were times I thought he was going to come across the table and throttle me. And he's going out in Randy Dorn fashion. I mean, he threw the governor, the legislature, and even the Supreme Court under the bus as he announced he's not going to run again. This has been his style. He's combative. He's angry. He has been the bomb thrower in chief, the shamer in chief, frankly, over school funding. And he's been unashamed about doing it. He was in the legislature. He feels like he knows what that job entails. He goes to become the head of the state superintendent of public instruction. And he felt like his job was to shout from the rooftops that the legislature wasn't getting the job done. And he still doesn't think that the legislature is getting the job done.
But here's what I don't understand, Austin. Clear up this one thing for us, if you would. He said, Randy Dorn said, if I stay on, I'll be so tough on the legislature and the governor because I'll so be pushing them to fulfill their oath of office that it will damage our relationship. So does he want somebody who's less passionate about the kids to run the schools? Where does that get us? What does he mean?
Well, I think that there's already a question about whether that relationship has sort of run its course in terms of any productivity at this point. Mm. Could it get worse if he ran for a third term and was reelected? Maybe. But, you know, I think that he may realize that the time has come for a different brand of public superintendent of public instruction, and or that he's just tired of fighting. But you know, when you talk to there's already people throwing. I mean, I don't think that this was a surprise. You know, there are other candidates who've already announced they're running for this office. There's others on the sidelines who will likely get in now. I think the sense was that Randy Dorn was done, and that he had done what he could do, and that he wasn't going to be able to, using his style, change a lot more in the next 4 years.
So, given what you know about the lay of the land and who might succeed Randy Dorn, what do you think my original question, it's supposed to be about the kids. So this guy's leaving. What does that mean for our school children?
It's a good question. I mean, one reality is that we have this elected superintendent of public instruction, but he or she does not control the purse strings. And so he or she can be focused on implementing of course standards. Testing has obviously been a big part of what OSPI is involved in. But to the extent that this is a conversation right now about school funding, and, you know, reform is in there as well, this is a legislative issue. I think in many ways this position is sidelined. In many ways this position isn't as relevant, at least at this point in history, as the legislators. So I think the question is, what does this job entail, and how does it affect kids when you think about the fact that local control is really at the crux of schools and the day-to-day experience for kids? I don't know that I can answer that question, Jim.
Yeah, right. It sounds like as to what it means for our kids, we have to leave on a question mark and watch what happens with our Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins. Austin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good to talk with you. Quick reaction, panel?
Well, I think it's really interesting because the superintendent basically has been reduced to arm waving and vigorously. And what has to happen at a broader political level in terms of leadership from the governor and whatnot. So it'd be interesting. It's a bully pulpit kind of job if it's done right. You can get somebody who can broker something. So maybe that's the approach that'll be taken. But it'd be highly politicized, I think, in the next round.
Former legislator?
I think Randy's done a good job. I think it is largely a bully pulpit, but I think he's used that well. And I think he can be proud of the fact that there is a dramatic increase in per student funding since he's taken that office, and especially in the last few years. And I think it's going to, need somebody with a strong personality to fill it in the future, because there's a long way to go.
Erica.
I agree with what Skip said about the need for, you know, for a larger political change, not just a conversation, but a change. And I think that, you know, this governor has clearly not accomplished that yet. So it's going to have to happen on the legislative level and not so much on the school superintendent level, because obviously Dorn is, you know, a bully at the pulpit.
Final topic on the Week in Review. Seattle suffered this week. Canute Berger posted a photo of that giant Bierstadt painting hanging at Seattle Art Museum, the dark, foreboding, stormy sea. And why?
Yeah, well, it was. I said it was a picture of the soul of a Seahawks fan after that terrible loss last week. But then we had a glorious victory, so the sun is breaking through the clouds now.
The sun came out. My proposal is that Seattle would be a better place if the Seahawks fell apart. Not forever, just this season. And if they do start winning again, just stop watching for a year. And my reasoning is the Seahawks used to be way more fun. I go way back to Steve Largent, Kenny Easley, all of that stuff. And we had a blast watching the game without being Super Bowl champions. We didn't take it that seriously because the Seahawks had never been any good. You're not going to over-identify with something that's bad. So therefore, you get to have the fun and not all the pomp and the, you know, the sort of militarism and stuff about how, oh, they're their hometown when they're not from here. And, you know, yelling like you know better than the coach and all that malarkey that comes with it. So it, better if they lost, right, Canute?
No. It's the difference between, you know, All My Children and Game of Thrones. You know, it's a drama. It's a soap opera. But one has a little more excitement.
Hey, Bill, they're still the Mariners.
Yes! That's big fun.
There you go. Time to jump on the bandwagon.
Canute Berger, by the way, is going to talk about what rain means to you a little bit later in the on our midday news magazine, The Record, at 12. And we're out of time. Eric, I know that's all you wanted to talk about was the Seahawks. Can I make it up to you?
You could just take my strategy and instead of not watching for 1 year, just don't watch at all.
Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank and not cornerback. Bill Finkbeiner used to be the state Senate majority leader on the GOP, and Canute Berger is the mossback at Crosscut and columnist at Seattle Magazine. Jason Pagano produces it. Bon Huberman's our social media producer. Join us on Twitter at KUOW, Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Thanks, engineer Bernard Ouellette, and thanks to you for joining us, and see you next week.